Welcome, everyone. My name is Neil McCluskey. I'm the director of the Center for Educational Freedom at the Cato Institute. Welcome our discussion today of the new book, Religious Liberty in Education, a case study of yeshivas versus New York. Now, the way we like to run the event, or at least I like to run the events, is I want to make this as much question and answer as possible. That means we take questions, comments, whatever it is you want to direct at the panel, and try and make most of the event about that. You can submit questions and comments on whatever platform you're on. There are all sorts of different ways to do it, depending on what platform you're watching us on. Certainly on Twitter and Facebook, you can use hashtag CatoCEF, that's CatoCEF, to get questions to me. And so I encourage you to think of questions, comments now, and submit them, and I get to as many as I possibly can. So that we can move this along as quickly as possible, because you want to get into the substance of it. I'm not going to go into the details of the bios of our terrific panel today. You can Google them. You can learn all you want about them on the internet. I'm just going to tell you quickly about who they are. And then I'm going to ask each one to answer just one question of mine to set up why this book exists, talk about their chapters, give you food for thought to generate your own questions and comments, and then we'll move on to those. So without further ado, first I'll be introducing Jason Bedrick. He's one of the co-editors of this book, along with J.P. Green and Matthew Lee. He's also a Cato adjunct scholar and director of policy at EdChoice. Second, we have Kevin Vallier. He's the associate professor of philosophy at Bowling Green State University, where he directs the program in philosophy, politics, economics, and law. And then we have Rita Koganzin. She's the associate director of the program on constitutionalism and democracy and a lecturer in the Department of Politics at the University of Virginia. So again, just a reminder, I'll be gathering questions and comments that you write, that you put into the whatever platform you're on. Just to start us off, I'm going to ask Jason first to tell us about a little bit about the book very quickly. And then, again, Kevin and Rita. And I'm going to ask them to by name, because we don't want to have a log jam of people answering questions and speaking all over each other, because we're on an online platform and that can happen more often. So it may seem a little unnatural, but that's going to keep everything flowing quickly so that we can move on to your questions and comments. And again, send those using hashtag CatoCEF. And so the first question I'm going to send to Jason, and Jason, what I'd like you to do, if you could, is just lay out why you wrote this book, maybe give us a little bit of background on the controversy in New York, and anything else you think we need to know about the book itself.
Sure. Well, first, thank you so much for hosting this event. We think that this is a book that addresses some very real and important issues today. Again, it is Religious Liberty, case study of yeshivas versus New York. Now, yeshivas are schools that Orthodox Jewish children attend, and there's been a controversy brewing in New York for the last several years over certain Haredi yeshivas. Haredi are also known as ultra-Orthodox, so that term is not really used in the community. Most of the yeshivas in New York are teaching secular education, but there are a small number that believe that they should be studying religious studies for almost the entire day, or in some cases, the entire day. And so a number of years ago, decade or so, there's been an organization called Young Advocates for Fair Education, which is mostly people who have grown up in the Haredi community and then left the community as adults, but believe that they didn't get a high quality secular education to which they believe they were entitled under the New York State's substantial equivalence law, which says that the education provided by private schools must be, quote, substantially equivalent, whatever that means, to what is provided in the public schools. And so even though this affects really, even within the Jewish community, even within the Orthodox Jewish community, a relatively small number of children, the questions that it raises are of much broader import. You can think of some of the religious liberty and education cases going back to the early 20th century. For example, when the KKK and nativists in Oregon in the early 1900s had persuaded the legislature to outlaw private education. There was a famous case, Pierce v. the Society of Sisters, in which the U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled on behalf of Catholic schools that the state could not outlaw private education. Even though Catholics were a religious minority, it had obviously broad implications even outside the Catholic community. Likewise, a few decades later, there was a decision concerning the Amish called Yoder v. Wisconsin v. Yoder, in which the Amish wanted to have an exemption under the First Amendment from the compulsory education law. Again, the Supreme Court sided with the Amish, saying that they did have a religious liberty interest in having their children exempt, at least beyond eighth grade, from the state's compulsory education law. So here too, you have a religious minority, but the questions that are raised by this case go far beyond this particular community. And so we look at it from, in this book, we address it from the view of political philosophy, from a constitutional perspective, and then also a practical perspective. So some of the political philosophy questions that are raised: who bears the primary responsibility for ensuring that children receive a quality education? Is it parents or is it the state? Who gets to decide what the minimum standard for education should be? When the desires of parents or religious communities conflict with the dictates of state policymakers, who should prevail and under what circumstances? From a legal perspective, do parents have a religious liberty interest that constitutionally outweighs the state's interest in having citizens learn certain skills or content that it believes necessary for an educated citizenry? Just because the religious minorities won in the previous two cases doesn't mean that they're going to prevail in this case. And indeed, those previous cases left the door open to a great deal of government intervention in private education. And how likely are courts courts likely to address this conflict, and how should they address this conflict? And then practically speaking, how has this issue been addressed before? What are the ramifications for other religious communities, for Jews, for Christians, for Muslims, and also for homeschoolers? How has this been addressed in Europe? And so that's what our book is organized around. We have a variety of academics, philosophers, historians, legal experts, school leaders and education practitioners that address these questions in an organized fashion that we think our readers will help illuminate not only the particular questions of this case, but the ramifications for society at large.
Yeah, well, and I'll say I of course, read the book. I'd feel terrible if I was moderating this and I'd read the book, and all those chapters are excellent, and you can really get I think all the different aspects you'd want dealt with of this question are all in there. Kevin, for you, I thought your chapter, I thought all the chapters were excellent, but you have sort of a systematic way of assessing when it may be appropriate for government to intervene in parental education decisions. Tell us a little bit about your chapter.
Just let me say thanks for having me on, and I was really delighted when Jason invited me to be part of the volume. One of the cool things that happened was that I got the opportunity to study what the kids at these yeshivas are learning, and I was completely blown away by the quality of their education. I mean, in many cases, they're being introduced to, say, legal or historical ideas or facts that kids twice their age aren't learning. So initially when I came into this case, I thought, oh, well, maybe these kids aren't getting a good education, but actually it's quite extraordinary what they're doing. So when I wrote the piece, I decided to try to set out in a very general way the conditions under which states could intervene in private religious school education, and then to see whether Yaphed's complaints were enough to satisfy those conditions. So I just began with a very simple principle of any free society, that there's a presumption against state coercion. The burden is on the state in order to explain or to explain or justify its intervention. And that's just because coercion can be very damaging, traumatizing, it can harm, it can kill. And so there needs to be a good reason to intervene. In the case of intervening in schools, I sort of outlined three different conditions. First, generally we defer to parents in educating their children, not only because we think they know best, but we oftentimes think that they have the right to educate their children, but those rights have limits. If, for instance, parents decide not to educate their children at all, we think the educational interests of children, their interest in being educated, outweighs the rights of parents, right? So if you just trapped your kids and taught them nothing for 10 years, that's not something parents have the right to do. So that would be a condition under which the state could intervene. And this is just in principle. I'm not saying this applies to this case. In fact, I'm saying the opposite. The intervention can't be excessively coercive or punitive. So what that means is that the government should use the least coercive means available in order to secure the educational interests of children, which again, you know, we're trying to avoid coercion and violence where we can, if we're interested in having a free society. And the third condition is that the government intervention, whatever it is, be shown to actually improve education for kids, right? Because if you're allowing people to use coercion, but there's no promise of it being any better once they're coerced, then that's not going to be enough to justify intervention. So those three conditions, you have to think the educational interests of children are threatened. What's proposed has to be the minimal amount of coercion required. And you have to think the coercion is going to be enough to improve things. And I actually think in this particular situation, I found in my research that none of these conditions were met, in part because the evidence that was provided that these educational interests were threatened was much too thin. You had a variety of people, for instance, making the complaints that were ruled not to have standing. The representativeness of the people who complained across the different schools was in question. Was there a representative sample of complaints, right? Otherwise, we don't know if the complainants are biased in some way. So there was just a lack of information about the educational interests of children being set back in a way that would override the educating interests of parents, right? Parents don't have to do everything right in order to get to decide how their children are raised. So I thought the second condition wasn't met either because there was excess coercion. In many cases, they were they're proposing to shut the yeshivas down entirely and to count the parents who didn't send their children to better schools as truant. Those are very severe legal penalties, so it seemed to me completely excessive. But I also thought that, you know, given the quality of schooling in New York State and New York City in many places, it just wasn't obvious that giving the state more power over these schools would actually improve the quality of their education, because when I looked at the quality of their education, it was pretty remarkable compared to what government may offer. So that's the basic idea. I tried to set out the conditions under which government intervention would be warranted, gave three conditions, and I found that in this case, none of those conditions were plausibly met. And so that's the basis on which I defended the religious liberty of these schools.
I'm sure we're going to delve into it a lot more. We have questions already coming in that start to get at the sort of nuts and bolts of what you're talking about. Rita, I want you to go first. I have to say, I don't know who wrote the chapter titles. And if you wrote your own chapter title, good for you. If someone else wrote it, good for them. But it's my favorite chapter title. Pork eating is not a reasonable way of life. If you want to have a controversial title, that seems like a good one. And so can you tell us what does that mean? And if you did write the title, go ahead and take credit for it, because I don't want to give it to Jason if you did it. And then tell us a little bit about what you're trying to say with that.
Sure. Yeah, that was my title. I was using a quote from Amy Gutman's book, Democracy and Education. No, actually, it was one of her articles. She's an educational theorist, and I was arguing against her, and she said pork eating is a reasonable way of life. So the purpose of my chapter is to take up the political theory that I think underlies a lot of the political criticism of the yeshivas. There's an intuition or belief that's held by many secular and educated people in the United States that the best kind of education for children in our society is one that will open as many doors as possible for them. And any education that would preclude children from becoming doctors or lawyers or marine biologists, or even one that would make it more difficult for them to follow these paths, is a bad education. And within the discipline of political theory, some theorists have expanded this intuition into a broader argument that the goal of education is autonomy. Autonomy is developed by protecting each child's, quote, right to an open future, and encouraging him to critically examine and revise his ideas about the good. And the best way to develop this kind of autonomy is by, as one theorist calls it, exposure to diversity. So you can see that religious education is often at odds with these aims, and the more intensely religious an education is, the more it would potentially limit exposure to the entire range of ideas and lifestyles out there that these theorists argue facilitate autonomy. But I think there are two basic reasons that this autonomy argument fails, especially in light of the current challenges facing liberalism. And so I defend the yeshivas sort of against this kind of theoretical understanding of what a good education is. The first reason, I think, is that although Education for Autonomy purports to give children a neutral and broad selection of lives, it actually has a very narrow vision of a good life. Its conception of autonomy as open-ended choosing elevates the kind of secular, upwardly mobile professional who can sort of function very well in a global economy. Such people appear maximally autonomous because they have access to the greatest number of lifestyle choices available in contemporary America, among the greatest variety of careers, of hobbies, friends, potential spouses, residences, and so on. And a successful education for an open future is actually an education for this particular kind of professional future. And so that's why you see this overlap between kind of secular educated opinion and academic political theory. In a way, it's the same demographic that's making that argument. An education for an open future is open in some ways, I think that's right, but it also closes off many possibilities. It makes it harder to justify pursuing, for example, a trade, since vocational training isn't as flexible and transferable a qualification as many college degrees are. It makes it difficult to justify remaining in your hometown or taking care of your family, since these choices close off future or even present opportunities. Ironically, it even makes it difficult to join a serious religious community like Orthodox Judaism, since without the requisite knowledge of the Hebrew language and the rituals that you would have gained during childhood, you'd be unable to participate in that religion. So elevating autonomy means diminishing all kinds of good lives and choices that just don't prioritize freedom from obligation. And the second problem that I see with autonomy education is that although exposure to diversity is intended to expand our capacity for independent thinking, it actually in a certain way undermines it by undermining the development of self-control, which is a virtue that's necessary for intellectual independence. Insisting that a well-educated person frequently revise his deepest moral commitments stunts the development of self-control, which is developed by commitment to principles and persistence in them, rather than their perpetual reconsideration. So the effectual result of an education for autonomy is, on one hand, the moral elevation of a kind of elite cosmopolitan educational and professional trajectory above more attainable and rooted ways of life. And on the other hand, it involves the deprioritization of the virtues of commitment and constancy and self-control in a regime that's most in need of extra support for these virtues. Hasidic education certainly doesn't prepare children for every career, but we have reasonable empirical evidence, I think, that it works for the Hasidic community, which has substantially lower rates of a lot of social pathologies that affect the non-religious lower class in the United States. The Hasidic community allows dissenters to exit. And even though that requires retraining for the secular world, as a lot of Yafed's complainants point out, just because it's not a cost-free exit doesn't mean that it's not a plausible option. And the point that I want to emphasize is that the other things that are overlooked by autonomy education have costs too, if you want to take them up later in your life. Becoming a Hasidic Jew, if you've received an education for autonomy, takes quite a bit of remedial education as well. So all educations are narrow and constraining in their own ways, but I think that in general, from the perspective of the country as a whole, pluralism is a better route. The more options we have in the United States for education, the better off we are. And so the quote about pork eating as a reasonable way of life Amy Gutman, who's one of these proponents of autonomy education, says parents certainly have a right to forbid their children to eat pork within their home, even though they also have a duty to allow their children to be exposed to the knowledge that eating pork is considered a reasonable way of life by many other people. And the argument that my chapter tries to make is that's not really an important knowledge that needs to be incorporated into education. Pork eating is not a really a reasonable way of life if you want to consider what a reasonable way of life is.
It's going to make me reconsider lots of my dietary decisions, but that's not really the topic right now. We have a lot of questions and comments that have come in. So I'm going to go to the first one that gets really to a fundamental question that you address. I don't know, it's in several chapters, so I can't say specifically whether it's in every chapter, I think it's also been a pretty substantial part of the debate. And so unfortunately the person, I don't have a name for who asked it, but they said, could it be argued that if the education is not substantially equivalent, you are not prepared for life outside of your community and then therefore become a ward of the state? Could that be argument enough for the state to intervene more? And I think that's a part of the overall YAFED discussion is, well, is there excessive or a lot of welfare use in the Hasidic Jewish community? And I just wanted to add one other thing about this that I know, Kevin, it seemed in your chapter you were grappling with, and I'm not sure whether you wrestled it to the ground or not. How much English should somebody in a school learn in order to be considered educated enough that the state should intervene? I'll go in sort of reverse order. I'll start with Rita, then Kevin, then Jason. So it's really kind of two questions. The one from the viewer is, if you know, if you become a ward of the state without substantially equivalent education, should it be imposed on you? And then I'm in particular interested in English as the language that you do or do not learn. So Rita, do you want to go first with that?
Sure, I can give a brief answer. I think that Jason probably will have a more thorough answer on the question of English, but on the question of the wards of the state, I mean, I guess my question about the question is, how are you gonna know in advance which child is gonna become a ward of the state? I mean, there is welfare use among the Hasidic community, but there's also a lot of welfare use among the secular community in the United States. And you know, a lot of public school graduates end up on welfare or using various, you know, state services. And we can't know in advance who that's gonna be when we think about it in terms of people who are not Hasidic. So should we say that all families who have children and are using state services, we need to more carefully monitor their children's education to ensure that they will not end up using the same social services? That would require a great deal of state intervention into family life and state supervision of child rearing. And I would imagine that most people would not be in favor of that for lower income and minority families in the United States. So I would assume that the same principle would apply for Hasidic families, that the fact that there are people in your community who are using social services should not put you under greater scrutiny by the state based on a kind of communal or associative likelihood of using social services. So I don't really see a strong case to be made for, is Hasidic education going to result in your being on welfare because some Hasidic people are on welfare? Well, some public education products are also on welfare. In fact, probably the majority of welfare recipients received a public education. And I will leave the language question, I think, to Jason and Kevin.
All right, Kevin, you want to go next?
Sure. I mean, on the first point, I just completely agree with Rita. I mean, you have to make the comparative judgment, right? You have to say, well, okay, so many of these students may end up on welfare, but then other people might too. They may end up on welfare even if there's state intervention. Do we have any reason to think the state intervention is going to make them less dependent or more dependent? Where's the evidence for that? Where's the data? Can you show this in a clear way that would be enough to justify the kinds of interferences that would be necessary or that have been proposed? So I think that that's just one very clear point of agreement, is that there'd have to be quite a lot of monitoring in order to meet that condition, and have to be applied pretty broadly. I mean, one example I use to illustrate this is, you know, drug testing welfare recipients. You know, a lot of people say, well, you know, we need to make sure they're not on drugs or something like that. But then for a lot of, say, classical liberal folks who want to say, well, we don't want welfare to go to waste, but they're also worried about the drug war and the kinds of interference with personal liberty that that involves. And so, you know, on the one hand, you know, you don't want waste. On the other hand, you just really don't want to be interfering with and monitoring people's lives constantly. And if you wanted to be consistent, you would have to do that not just for the Haredi children, but across the board. And that would be quite striking. So that's just to agree with Rita. The language question was actually one that was pretty difficult for me because I was learning the kind of language mastery that these students have. So oftentimes they have at least two languages. So the question would be, you know, should they be required to learn English? And the really interesting case here is that the politics of it is kind of flipped. So on the one hand, now, instead of the right being the ones who say, you know, you have to learn English, you have to speak English, you have, in this case, it looks like some on the left saying, no, you have to know English. But I think a lot of the students will end up picking up a lot of English because it's the dominant language that they've spoken, and they have really good linguistic skills in other languages. So I was kind of on the fence about whether English was required, because it seems like these students could pick it up. They will have already picked a lot of it up. But there's still a lot I don't know about the community. So I just hand it over to Jason in order to give the sort of full background there.
Yeah, I don't have that much more to add to what Rita and Kevin said. I would just, on the first question, it's interesting that people think of welfare usage or Medicare, Medicaid usage as being a ward of the state, but not public school usage. So in New York City, the average per pupil expenditure is about $30,000. So these families that don't use the public schools, they're saving for each child about $30,000 per pupil. So if they have a family that the Haredi communities tend to have a very large family. So if you've got a family that has eight children, which is pretty typical, then we're talking about $240,000 a year. So even if they are receiving some welfare benefits or some Medicaid benefits, are they receiving $240,000 worth of those benefits? I don't think so. In most cases, I highly doubt that. We don't have a lot of great data to prove it one way or the other. And yes, the community does have a higher than average usage, so far as we can tell, of welfare usage and other aid programs. But they also have very large family sizes, and so they're much more likely to qualify for those. So they could be earning six figures, but if you have, you know, 8 to 12 kids, you're going to end up qualifying. So when you adjust for family size, it's not clear that their usage is actually that much greater than average. And so at what point, you know, is it if their community has a 5% or 10% or 25% greater likelihood of using one of these programs, is that the point at which we say that the state now has to interfere? I don't think that's the case. And as a matter of fact, we also see too that even some of the people that started YAFED ended up going on to receive graduate degrees in, you know, higher education. The founder of YAFED himself graduated summa cum laude from state college and then went on to get a master's degree in social work. How held back was he really? I'm sure it was extremely difficult to transition from one community to another. And it's also quite difficult to transfer in the reverse. But does that mean that the parents no longer have an interest in educating their children or an interest against the state interfering in that form of education? As to the English question, certainly I think that there is a moral duty that parents have to educate their children in a language. And not just a language that, you know, if they made up a language or if, you know, they were, you know, teaching their children Klingon or something like that, you know, that a handful of people speak, that I think is insufficient. It has to be a language that there is a, you know, a critical mass of people speak. You know, and in this case, Yiddish, you've got hundreds of thousands of people that are speaking Yiddish. They have, you know, if you go into some of these neighborhoods, you see that there are flyers all over the neighborhood in Yiddish, that the signs are in Yiddish. This is what they speak. We don't have a national language in the United States. There are more than 300 languages that are spoken. English obviously is the dominant one, but we don't, it's not a national language in the sense that we don't force anybody to learn it. And most of these people, they live in New York. It's not like they're out in the woods. They are exposed to English all the time. They speak English sort of as a second language, like a lot of first generation immigrants. But it's a language that not only they have, as Kevin pointed out, they usually speak English, Hebrew, and have fluency in Aramaic. They have the skills to acquire other languages. I think that's what's most important.
The Meturgamin on Twitter, he would like the panel to discuss the allegedly bigoted history of the substantially equivalent clause and whether or not that is relevant today. And I think, Jason, would you like to take that?
Sure. And I would, anybody who's interested in this question, I think one of the best treatments of it was an article in Education Next, I think maybe it was 2 or 3 years ago, by Menachem Wecker. It was titled New York State Cracks Down on Jewish Schools. And he pointed out that the substantial equivalency requirement essentially was passed at the same time that New York State adopted its version of the Blaine Amendment. Now, for those who don't know what's the Blaine Amendment, there was a Senator James G. Blaine from the state of Maine, who was a prominent nativist, who was worried about Catholics bringing with them Romanism and rebellion, you know, in the late 1800s. And so he was pushing an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would prevent public funds from going to so-called parochial schools, which meant wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Catholic schools. Now, at the time, the common schools or the public schools were de facto non-denominational Protestant. They taught the Protestant version of the Bible. They led students in non-denominational Protestant prayer. But obviously this didn't work for Catholics and to a lesser extent Lutherans and many other religious, you know, non-Christian religious groups like Jews and Muslims. So when some of those groups, particularly the Catholics, said, well, look, our tax dollars are funding your Protestant schools, we would like those tax dollars also to go to our Catholic schools, they said, oh, no, you have parochial schools. We have schools that are open to anybody, and you're, you know, of course, welcome to send your children to our public schools, and we'll Protestantize them for you. That amendment failed at the federal level, but it was adopted in almost 40 states at the state level, in the state constitution. And at the same time, they said, okay, you Catholics, you can have your own schools. We're not going to publicly fund them, but you can have them. But you have to teach something that is substantially equivalent to what's going on in the public schools. We don't want you to look too different than our Protestant common schools. So that's really where it came from. It's the law itself is rooted in anti-Catholic bigotry. Interestingly, it essentially lied dormant for about a century because the Catholics were actually eager to prove that they were teaching something that was substantially equivalent to the public schools. They just said, look, we're just like you, just, you know, we have a Catholic flavor and you've got a Protestant flavor, but otherwise we're good citizens just like everybody else. It wasn't until much later when Protestants and now especially, you know, some forms of Orthodox Jews said, no, we want something that is substantially different than what the public schools are offering. And now it raises all these sorts of interesting questions.
Great. So I don't think anybody else, did anyone else want to add anything to that? If not, I've got lots of good questions that have come in. Unfortunately, several of them, I don't know the names of the people, so I can't give them credit for the good questions. But one of them asked for Kevin specifically, can you share more specifics about the remarkable education you witnessed in Hasidic yeshivas in New York? And they would like to know whether or not that extends beyond the term they used was Judaics. I assume that means other yeshivas. And I'm also sort of, as part of that question, I'm going to throw my own question in. Suppose the education wasn't remarkable. Should it still be something that is off limits for government to interfere in? Suppose it's just kind of average but different.
So I didn't physically observe of this, but the research that I did on the reading that I did, I think what was remarkable was just learning how extensive the education in the Talmud is, and the fact that they're reading things like commentary on laws, so disagreements essentially among lawyers. So a lot of the legal concepts that they would have to become familiar with was one of the things that really, really surprised me. But there's also, you know, learning multiple languages, right? Learning a huge amount of history. So you know, the Old Testament, as you know, we Christians call it, it just by itself is actually a very long series of books. It takes a very long time to get through it. So even it's not just learning sort of the details of the Old Testament narratives and how this person interpreted it and this person interpreted it, but knowing the history of the commentary on those books, that was so striking to me, because it requires all kinds of different tools, right? It requires historical tools, it requires legal tools. So that was what impressed me about, you know, what I was able to look into. Now, of course, I think that is what we philosophers say, a sufficient condition for there to not be intervention, given that the education is high quality. But it's not necessary. And so, you know, lower quality education is not necessarily going to be vulnerable to state intervention just because it isn't as impressive. As I say in the article, it still has to, you know, the intervention would still have to satisfy the relevant conditions. If the education was lower quality, it may not do as much good for the children. But the thought would, you know, it'd still have to be the case that the problems were so large that they outweighed the interests of parents, that the proposed punishments not be excessively coercive or punitive, and we'd have to show that the government could do a better job. And it's perfectly plausible that in you know, lower quality educational environments, those conditions still are not met.
Rita?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, in terms of the question about observing the schools, a really good source on that is Moshe Kurkowski, who is a professor at Yeshiva University, who does sort of anthropological studies of yeshiva education, including these the Haredi yeshivas that are controversial for what they teach. So anybody who is interested in that, I think he's a very good source for that. And then the question about, well, if it's not remarkable, you know, should we still permit it? I think in all curricula, results are always more varied than intentions, right? So you have even excellent schools that are producing some pretty lackluster individuals. But I don't know that, you know, you have to have a sort of 99% excellence rate in order to justify the kind of non-standard education that you're offering. I mean, in this case, we have a 1,000-year-old educational tradition. So the fact that it has persisted that long, I think, is good reason to suggest that there's something really substantial behind it. And I think, you know, you can get to the sort of floor, the question of the floor. What's the floor at which we say no, right? How low quality can the education be before we intervene and say, you can't give this? But I actually think that the best approach to thinking about that is through sort of the question of individual child abuse. I mean, that's sort of what people are getting at when they say this education is substandard. There's a legal question about substantial equivalence, but there seems to also be this moral question about, are these children essentially being abused by having these opportunities taken away from them, by being indoctrinated into some kind of minority religious sect? And I think the best way to approach that is through the civil understanding we have of abuse, where we investigate individual families and individual cases, and we apply a set of universal standards for what abuse consists in. And if you can't meet those standards, you can't simply say that just because I don't like your religion or I don't understand your religion, that constitutes abuse or a kind of deprivation and neglect that we need to intervene in systematically.
Great. Okay. I have I have a comment and a question. Both come from AC. The first one said, why not invite Yafed founders or other yeshiva graduates who claim they were denied an education, I think, to this event? That's a good question. That is on me. I'm the one who put this together. And that would be actually a subject for, I think, a terrific future event. I really wanted to do an event that was focusing specifically on the content of this book, Religious Liberty and Education, A Case Study of Yeshivas versus New York. But I think it is important that we have more events where we're sort of debating these issues with both sides represented. So that is a great idea for a future event. And then AC also says that what Jason said about substantial equivalency was something of a made-up history. They believe that the requirement of substantial equivalency was to ensure that all children attend schools one way or another, and that there's a level playing field. And that does get to this question of, you know, who ultimately gets to decide whether and where you hit that line where an education is sufficient for that individual to eventually run their own lives and when it is not sufficient. I don't know who wants to go first with that one, but I'll let Jason go because he's the editor. So he put the whole thing, the whole book together. I'm responsible for the event.
Yeah, and certainly we'd love to do an event with Yafed. We'd be happy to. It's interesting, though, that at Yafed events, that question never comes up in the reverse, where Yafed only has people that agree with them, and they don't tend to invite somebody that was very happy with their yeshiva education to explain why that person shouldn't have access to the education that they had and enjoyed. As far as this other question, yeah, this is not a made-up history. Like I said, you can go and take a look at what the history was. There was a compulsory education requirement that was meant to make sure that every child had access to an education. But the specific language of that, what the private schools are doing must be substantially equivalent to what the public schools are doing, which you don't find in most states. The compulsory education is basically every state. Substantial equivalence is not something that you find everywhere. That was specifically targeted at Catholics, but I would direct folks to look at not only Menachem Wecker's article on that, which I mentioned on Twitter, somebody tweeted that out, but also some of the great work of Professor Charles Glenn, formerly of Boston University, and his work, The Myth of the Common School, which gets into great detail about all the anti-Catholic bigotry surrounding the Blaine Amendment, and even to a great extent, the foundation of the common school system.
Great. All right. Then we have a question from Mallory. She asks, Kevin, is there a concern that your reliance on the quality of education is signaling that it's worthy of protection? Does that undermine the religious freedom basis for arguing that religious communities should be able to run their own schools? For example, if the quality was less, then would that outweigh the religious freedom of those families? So, and that gets, I think, to an important part of this is, we're talking a lot about religious liberty, but what if there was an excellent school that had no religious connection that was still doing a good job, but it was a community that was very different? Would the same calculus of determining when government could intervene apply to that school and to that community as would apply to Orthodox Jewish schools?
Yeah, I think the way that I approach this issue is that you have to balance two interests. The first are the educational interests of children, and then they're what I call the educating interests of parents, right? So we think generally we should default to what parents want to do as far as educational choices for their kids, and then we have to look at, you know, what we think sort of together actually are the things that children are owed, and then whether and when those interests are outweighed. And part of the educating interests of parents are that they be able to be brought up in their religion, their particular religion, or something along those lines, like maybe their ideology or their values or something of that sort. So it's a balance of interests, and the quality of education figures into how well the educational interests of parents are being met. But when balancing interests, I think you find in political philosophy is it's very difficult to do in a principled way. So I try to set up those criteria without being able to specify the precise point at which there's a trade-off. My argument in the article, because it was applied to this particular case, was just that once you put the point in that way, it was clear that the educating interests of parents and that the educational interests of children were substantially aligned. There wasn't even really a conflict between the two. So the kind of conflict that we're worried about between quality of education and religious freedom didn't even arise. But if there were such a conflict, I think you have to go more case by case. It's hard to have a fully principled answer to that kind of question.
Now, this is going to kind of flip things a little. If nobody wants to answer, that's fine. But I think it presents an interesting counterpoint to this. Gerald asks or says, I would be more inclined to hear of a case regarding a plaintiff withstanding versus the New York City public school system for not providing an education, preparing a child for any role in our society. And several of the chapters, I think, talked about, there are these allegations against yeshivas of not preparing people to live as self-governing adults. But look at the public school system. Are they doing any better? So would one of you like to address whether or not the public schools are doing any better? And maybe even the question of, when could you sue the government if you feel the education you're getting is not good enough? And I should note there have been a few cases recently about people saying that their education did not prepare them to be adults and especially to be productive citizens. Maybe I'll ask Rita if you want to take that first. If not, I will send it around the horn.
Sure. One could say of the substantial equivalence requirement, right? Substantially equivalent to what? To Stuyvesant or to the average of New York City public schools or to the worst performing New York City public schools? Because certainly it would seem that the results from Jewish yeshivas in the city of New York are likely to be, in fact, I think they empirically are better than the results of the worst performing New York City public schools. So in that respect, substantial equivalence, that's part of the vagueness of substantial equivalence, which is substantially equivalent to what, given how poorly some public schools are performing. So I would say that the substantial equivalence standard, if you want to uphold it, would open the way certainly to certain lawsuits against the public school system for not being substantially equivalent to itself. Right, that there's a huge disparity in the quality of public schooling in New York City and elsewhere in the country. But that, to me, would seem to militate against substantial equivalence as a viable sort of legal standard, that's not the outcome we want. We don't want people suing for substantial equivalence to Stuyvesant, a universal substantial equivalent to Stuyvesant or something like that. But I think that that's a very good point. And I think that's one of the problems also that comes up with this argument about welfare use, which is that, if the Hasidic community uses welfare at a high rate, shouldn't we in some way surveil and penalize them for that? But I think that that would have to be a principle universally drawn. And then we would have to do the same thing to public school students, right? That most recipients of welfare are public school graduates. And so maybe we should be doing the same things to public school students. So yeah, I mean, I definitely think that this kind of approach to what the state's interest is in education and what the state's role in regulating education is can lead down a lot of problematic pathways.
Great. AC weighs in again, says Yafed is an advocacy group. Asks, is Cato an advocacy group for yeshivas to maintain the status quo? I can't answer for Cato. I can only answer for myself. But again, I put this event together. The reason that we're having this event is because there's a new book, and this book isn't actually just about yeshivas. That is the jumping off point for a deeper discussion of when the state can intervene in any way in education. But I certainly agree that it would be great to have an event with Yafed, somebody from Yafed here, maybe Jason, others. And feel free to reach out to me. I'm nmccluskey@cato.org, cato.org, and I would be happy to host that. In fact, you can see that we often have events where we have lots of different views. In fact, not too long ago, we had an event that was related to this question, all about homeschoolers. And we had two speakers who were thought there should be a whole lot more regulation of homeschools. So I think we typically do a good job of trying to get multiple views. And we're not advocates, or I'm not an advocate in any way for yeshivas or anyone else, although I am an advocate for educational freedom. And connected to that brings us to our next question. And this moves beyond now just when a school can be regulated by the state without a just for existing, basically, and whether or not it provides the education a child needs to become a self-governing adult. This person is anonymous. No, sorry, name is Roger. And Roger says, in England, religious schools can be state-funded, and problems have arisen even in them with allegations of extremism in Muslim schools. Do different principles arrive where the state, when the state subsidizes private schools? And does anybody want to start with that? Jason, I know you do a lot of work on school choice. Is this different than, say, a voucher program?
I mean, there are a number of cases where states already say that private schools, this, by the way, first of all, there's a lot of regulations on private schools, even when they don't get a dime from the state. And there are different regulations that say that private schools can't be, you know, teaching insurrection, violent insurrection against the government and things like that. Although a lot of them haven't been tested in court. And one wonders what the, you know, early American colonists would have thought if King George had said that you can't be teaching anti-government views in the schools. So it is really hard to draw the line, I think, when it comes to the teaching, you know, something like teaching of violent extremism. You know, maybe the line has to be drawn somewhere, but I think we should always err on the side of freedom. And it doesn't seem that the United States or Britain even, which has a much higher percentage of the population is Muslim, actually have an issue where violent extremists are in any danger of actually, you know, taking over, overthrowing the government. So I think as much as possible, we should err on the side of freedom.
Great. All right. We got about 8 minutes left. And here's a question that comes from Mark. And this is one that I've had as I was reading the book. In particular, it actually may be most applicable to actually Berner's a chapter that talks about pluralism versus a common school approach versus a libertarian approach. But also, Kevin, you dealt with this about, well, is there some nucleus of subjects that all students should take? And so Mark asks, are there certain courses and standards that are so essential, for example, civics and media literacy, that the state must require proficiency that at all citizens, so that all its citizens and consequently its communities are substantially fulfilled? How does that apply here, if at all? And in particular, my question related to that is, where do you draw the line, or how is the line drawn to say, well, everybody has to learn a certain amount of history? Where do you draw the line on what that history is before you get to the point where you were talking about controversial history that people simply disagree about? How do you make sure that people are actually required to learn, if you require something like that, something that everybody would agree on as being essential?
I mean, I think that's precisely the way that you at least try to figure out what's essential, which you have to look at what different perspectives can converge upon or from different perspectives agree is essential. And I think everyone will agree that reading, writing, and math are absolutely minimum essentials that I think the yeshivas are giving to their students in spades. Then we've raised the question about what kind of language use is essential. Does it have to be English? You know, but I think everyone can agree that if you're fluent in reading and writing in one or two languages that are live and active, you know, that's also a minimum standard. My own view is I would add, in terms of civics, that people know what their basic constitutional rights are as citizens. So, for instance, you can imagine religious communities that taught their children that they had no right to leave. when in fact they do have a constitutional right to leave at a certain age, or that they have certain other constitutional rights in terms of speech and freedom of religion. So I would add that as a minimum point for civics, civics education. There are a lot of other things you might think are relevant too, but I think that's a very good place to begin. History, you know, becomes more controversial, particularly in the case of a lot of religious schooling where there's usually a pretty deep difference between the way people think about origins and what's taught in secular schools.
So our last question, unfortunately, I don't have a name for the person who sent it, but this is an interesting question. They say, those who either leave Hasidic communities and pursue higher education successfully, or remain but are successful in business, or are otherwise self-sufficient, encounter serious obstacles and barriers. Their successes are despite where they come from and what they learned in yeshiva, not because of it. And that, I think, raises a good question of, well, when do we, where do you draw that line when the state should intervene of, well, you've been so handicapped you could never succeed, versus, well, you've got a lot of obstacles, but you can succeed. Jason?
Yeah, well, first I'd say, even if we were to assume that it's despite their upbringing that they're able to succeed, the fact is, they're able to succeed. And so that really diminishes the argument that the government should be intervening, that it's such a huge obstacle that they can't. But I think actually it's a mistake to make that assumption. I think, and this is where I think a lot of the critics of yeshiva education, especially those actually that grew up with it, don't appreciate what they actually learned. They may be deficient in their view in terms of the content that they learned, but they actually learned a great deal of skills and habits of the heart that really do help them obtain a secular education and help them in life, help them in business, help them in other areas. I sort of experienced this from the reverse. I grew up in a very secular home. I went to public school for most of my life, Catholic high school. And it was only after college that I went to yeshiva and sort of had this culture shock where I had to, you know, suddenly I'm learning texts in the original Hebrew and Aramaic, and there are all these, you know, concepts that are entirely foreign to me that I had a lot of catching up to do. But when the students go through a yeshiva education, they learn how to start studying very early in the morning and study all the way till very late at night. They learn how to take a text that they're unfamiliar with there's a whole bunch of, let's say there's a legal argument with a bunch of different rabbis that are arguing over a certain issue. And then you've got the commentaries on that and commentaries on the commentaries. And so you may have one medieval commentator, Rashi, understands this dispute one way. Tosfos comes in and says, we understand it a different way. Then you have Rabbeinu Hananiel or some other commentator come in and say, well, we understand it a third way. And so by the end, you started with three different opinions. And in the end, you've got 9 or 12 different opinions, right? So this ability to closely read a text, to analyze it, to approach the issue, study it from multiple different angles, to sit with a chavrusa, a study partner, and bat the ideas around back and forth until you have a really deep, rich understanding of the text before you move on. These are, study habits and ways of learning that these students acquire that do actually prepare them for life, that do actually prepare them. They can take these skills and habits and apply them in entirely different areas. I think actually those students, even if they haven't formally learned English or anything like that, or spent time with a science class, are actually much better prepared than the kid at the public school down the street who graduates 12th grade without being able to read the diploma that he is handed. So I think it's, again, I think first you can't prove it one way or the other, but I think that there's a strong reason to believe it's actually not despite the education that they receive that they succeed in life, but actually because of it.
We are now at 2 o'clock, and so I want to thank all the panelists who joined us today. Again, the book right here is Religious Liberty and Education, a Case Study of Yeshivas versus New York. And this video will be up for anybody to watch in perpetuity. So with that, I'll thank Jason for putting the book together and all the panelists and everyone for joining us. Thank you.